Okay, so what we call this a synthetic information system. The data that we're building is not real data. You can't find individual people in it, but it represents what we need to know about the system. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how to use synthetic information for getting actual public health results out. So first, let me say that this is it's a feasible thing to do. It sounds kind of science fiction-y at first, but it's possible to make a synthetic population for studying the way epidemics work. The first thing we do is we model census data. We put in things like distributions of individual demographics. We assign individuals to households. We make a population which, if you took a census of the population, the census would be indistinguishable from the actual census. The trick here is to get the joint distributions right. Otherwise, it's pretty obvious how to do it. Then we associate these people, these synthetic people, with activities and times and places where they perform these activities. We get the places from things like Dun & Bradstreet data. They're actual locations with things like numbers of employees at the location, number of students at the school. We model movements of people as they try to perform activities that are reasonable things for them to do. So these are our synthetic people down here. We have survey data, time use data, activity survey data that we can associate with the individuals by the demographics that we've already given them. Then we have another model that says, well, if I'm going to go to a workplace, where am I likely to be working? If I live here, I have this income, where should I be working? If I'm going to stop to shop on the way home from work, where is it likely that I'll stop? So it's all made up, but it's all very much more realistic than previous kinds of models would have been. And I highlighted model all over the place to convince you that this is not just a model. This is a whole set of models that provides a framework for fusing data from all kinds of different sources into one coherent set of information. So far in the synthetic population, we've got like a cartoon of a typical family's day in this population, where one person, the green person, takes a carpool to work, goes out to lunch, goes back to work, and comes home. Someone else takes the car shopping with someone with a kid who needs to be placed in daycare while they're out shopping and get back together. And these lines here are meant to indicate that when they're all in the same place, like at home, they have opportunities to transmit disease. Of course, everybody else in the synthetic population is also performing their activities and doing them in specific places. So when this child gets to the daycare center, there are other kids there, and it has opportunities to transmit disease at the daycare center. And the same for all the other places, the workplaces, the homes. So putting it all together, we do get a representation of a population in a particular place, like San Francisco, doing the kinds of things that people in that place normally do and the places where they do them. So what can you do with this kind of synthetic data? There's lots of, it's just a data set. You can use it like you would any data set, which means there's an enormous number of ways to analyze it and to think through what it means. So here's one example. In the typical kind of systems dynamics model, you might have a knob that says, what's the transmission rate? And if somebody came to you and said, I'd like to investigate what would happen if we could reduce transmission rates by 50%, they would turn the knob. In this approach, though, we don't have a knob like that. Somebody says, I want to reduce transmission, you have to think through what you're doing. So maybe it means you'll split the people into two separate groups so there are half as many people in a group with probability with an opportunity to transmit. Or it might mean I'll just reduce the number of possible opportunities by half, which is different from the first thing. Or it might mean everybody's still in a big group interacting with each other, but somehow I've protected them. Maybe I've put face masks on or something, so that there's less probability of transmission. And all these things, they have different effects on the system. And if you're not representing it in this disaggregate way, it's easy to lump them all into one factor. And we try to avoid doing that. Now, some people, reviewers, for example, complain that this is too complicated a model. And everyone knows from time immemorial that simpler models are better. But I want to argue that that's not necessarily the case. So here's a model. This is not the tube. This is a model of the tube that lets me know how to get from point A to point B. It's a very complicated model, but it represents complications that are in the system itself. Here's a simpler model of the same thing, and I argue that the simpler model is much less useful for someone who's trying to get from here to there. I'd much rather use the complicated model. So that was a discussion of how we build the models. Now I'm going to tell you a few things that we've done with them. This was work that we did as part of the MIDAS consortium, where we were asked to evaluate this targeted layered containment strategy, which just happens to have the same acronym as Tender Loving Care, for an influenza pandemic. And I'm not going to describe everything we did. I'm just going to point out that there were three different modeling groups who took on this task, represented by the different colors. We had these six different scenarios that people wanted us to look at. And the question was, could you achieve containment with any of these scenarios? And what we established was that there was wide agreement across the groups that yes, you could establish containment in certain circumstances, even though the individual groups varied a lot in what their estimates of the attack rate would be. So we viewed this as a big success, and we can even go into the models and explain why we see some of this variation. Here's another example. During the H1N1 pandemic, we did some work for HHS directly. They wanted to know about the mid to late November timeframe if we should be expecting a third wave of influenza. We'd already seen two peaks. And I showed this slide to explain that sometimes people who see simulations, they're used to seeing numbers like I showed over here. You know, what's the total attack rate? And this is the only analysis you get from the simulation. What we showed here was that we could trace back the factors that would determine whether or not there would be a third wave. So I'm sure you can't read what's in these boxes of the decision tree, but that's what the factors were that showed up all over the place. And depending on the answers to those questions, we could give you some estimate of whether there might be a third wave. For those of you who are familiar with network kind of models like this, you may have seen things that say, well, I can tell you by looking at this network that this is what the outcomes you'll see will be. And one thing I want to stress is that as we put more details into the network, we find that we can get some surprising results. So, for example, this was a model of the New River Valley, which is about 100,000 people. It's a small model. And what we did, there are two models shown here. In one of them, we went into the schools. We got administrative data on class schedules for students. We did surveys of the students to ask who their friends were, who they spent time with. So the schools in one of them are very well represented in great detail. In the other model, they're not. In all these static measures of network structure, there's no significant difference between the two networks. If you send a disease across them, though, you get a significant difference. So this is number of people exposed as a function of time. And it may not look like a huge difference, but I would just point out this is about a 20-day difference in the timing of the peak, which could be really important if you're trying to develop a vaccine against this. And it's about a 10% or so difference in the height of the peak, which is substantial. One more study that I'm really keen on, actually, so I talk about it every chance I get. We took a network for Miami. We said, suppose a respiratory disease comes through, and you can't take care of all the people who are sick in the hospitals. What should you tell people if they're taking care of household members? Well, the obvious thing is to try to isolate the sick household member from everybody else in the household, if it's possible. And maybe to have a single caregiver who's responsible for contact with the sick person instead of having uniform mixing within the house. Again, it's a very small change to the network, and it's a fairly obvious thing. And what we see is that we can get a dramatic change in the attack rate on the bottom is for a wide range of transmissibilities. The units won't mean much to anybody, but down here are sort of seasonal flus, and up here are novel influenzas. So this looks all nice, but there's one problem with it, which is that we don't really know where we are now. So we can't say, if you implement this, you'll get that much of a difference, because this is the case when everybody just lets sick people wander around their household infecting everybody else. And in fact, this is a symptom of a much more, it's a deeper problem. It's a problem that these two models fall in the same universality class, in a sense, so that I can shift this entire curve over to that one just by redefining what I mean by transmissibility, which means that the model is very hard to identify. It's hard to calibrate correctly. So you have to be careful sometimes with the analyses you get out of the models. And the last thing I want to talk about as far as analyzing the models is looking for causes in the models. So on the left are epidemic curves from, about 18 counties in Washington State. It's all the same epidemic. And it's been run over and over again. So these are average results. And what you see is a variation in the way the epidemic sweeps through the county. Now, if you've been following along, the cause of this variation is that the networks are different in each county. But that's not a very satisfying explanation. So I'm gonna take a leap and go one step farther back and say, well, what causes the difference in the networks? It's demographics. And you can analyze these outcomes in a way that makes, to me, a lot of sense for public health applications. So what we did, for example, here is to say, if the mean household size in the county is less than 2.4 and less than 23% of the population is school age, then you'll get one sort of set of outcomes. And I bring this up, I like it as an example, because it shows that, I mean, we all know that correlation is not causation, right? We built a model, we've put a bunch of correlations into this synthetic information. We think that those are the correlations you would observe in the real world. And then we've added on top of that this dynamic modeling of disease spreading through the system. And I don't think anyone would argue that the dynamic model is not causal. We put causes for these dynamics in there. And because they're related in this very peculiar way to the things like demographics, we can develop a causal model for how demographics affects this dynamical outcome. And I think I've just made a hash of that argument, but it's a different way of looking at a data resource. We're not just looking for static correlations and trying to infer something about what might have caused what. We can see what causes what in the simulation. So I'm just going to say that all the stuff I talked about, that's what we think we've contributed to this field, is developing the methodology of synthetic information systems. And I should also say that when I use the word we through this talk, it's not out of some sense of royalty or editorial nature. It's really contributions from a lot of people over a lot of time. And I think that's all I have. I think this would be a great use of the system. In fact, along with what seems like half the people here, I'm trying to understand how we can apply this to tobacco control. Because one of the ways to see this is that we have all these people interacting. They're interacting with each other at the individual level, but they're also creating a sort of aggregate social phenomenon, I guess you can call it. And they can interact with the social phenomenon. So there are multiple levels of aggregation in this system, and there are interactions. We put the interactions in at the bottom, but things in the Santa Fe Institute words, the interactions emerge with between individuals and other levels. And it gets to an aspect of especially implementing interventions that I think is important, that just putting an intervention, it's a translational problem. If you implement something that you know will work at the individual level, there's still no guarantee that when you put it out in public, it's going to work. And I think these kinds of simulations, based on this sort of synthetic information, can get at that, yeah, things.
So, somewhat related to that question, and I'm not sure if they how this was done. That's why I'm kind of putting it out. But the Institute of Medicine just put out in their report, one of the reports was a workshop on looking at violence, and they used basically a contagion theory to show how and talking about how violence is contagious. So if you're thinking about violence as a public health issue, and they're using a contagion model. And I had this is something that came across my email just before I was leaving. So I don't know if that's similar, but it seems like there have been.
So did they just put that out? Okay.
Just put out. It was just their last newsletter that just came out. It was one of a workshop that was done on violence, and they used the contagion model and said violence is contagious.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
Nice to see what system, what dynamic system they used to do that. I didn't get a chance to review it.
There are a lot of contagion. They call them generalized contagion or models, where you can say something like, "I'll change my mind if some threshold number of my peers that I'm in regular contact with change their mind," or I'll become violent if some other. There's a whole developing field of computational social science that tries to understand things like the Arab Spring and a wide range of issues, and I really want to make sure it remains or it gets applied in issues of public health. And that brings up a lot of the issues of understanding causation and confounding things. In these networks, it can get very complicated.